Well, welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast, the second part of the 50th episode, which is the 50 greatest moments that we started last week. I'm Andy Bissett. I'm joined by James Allen and Liam Flynn yet again. And Jim, are you going to go through sort of where we are in terms of our red cards and where we are with how many we've already inducted into the top 10? And obviously, this is subject to change. So just give us a bit of a rundown of where we are.
Yeah, so as of right now, 7 of the top 10 places, they've been filled in, and I'm kind of happy that it's going to be subject to change, because I definitely want to reassess one of my picks and, you know, just get a few World Wrestling Entertainment choices in there up for consideration, a couple of bodybuilding picks, you know, no animal-related records whatsoever here on the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. So we'll go through the top 7. Number 1. Tom Brady wins a Super Bowl with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Number 2, Michael Jordan, second three-peat with the Chicago Bulls. Number 3, Jesse Owens sticking it to the Natties. Is that the 1936 Olympics? Number 4, Ronaldo versus Lionel Messi, the greatest footballing rivalry of all time. Number 5, the Spain's national team, three-peat as well from 2008 to 2012, winning the international tournaments throughout that time. I think they barely lost a game during that run as well. Number 6, 1974, Muhammad Ali, George Foreman, and the Rumble in the Jungle speaks for itself. Number 7 speaks for itself as well. Liverpool winning the Champions League in 2005 against AC Milan, 3-0 down in the first half. So, that's the top 7. And as far as red cards go, I think, Bissett, you're the only one to use one so far, but I can't actually remember what it was for. Let me scroll up here.
I think it was for Bret the Hitman Hart.
Oh, it was, yeah, the Montreal Screwjob. Shame on you, Bissett, but well fished, Flynn. So I know you got him out there with that one.
I haven't forgotten that one.
Had to use a red for something that shouldn't even be eligible for a sports moment.
Wait, hold your horses there, Bissett. Hold your horses there, mate. Sports entertainment, come on. If darts is a sport.
We're going to put it out to the listeners, like, does wrestling or should wrestling, any wrestling moment be allowed near a top 50 sporting moments? That's going to be another. So we're going to put a poll out. Obviously, we're going to have the survey. We're going to have the survey so like the fans can pick the top 10 once we've gone through today and we've decided on them. They're going to rank them in order of 1 to 10. So we're also going to put out, should that be allowed anywhere near it?
Well, lest we forget, Kurt Angle, multiple time WWE champion, he won an actual gold medal in wrestling in 1996 with a broken neck. Genuine athletic achievement.
Which is genuine, like, Olympic sport, whereas wrestling,
yeah, you said wrestling of any kind, mate. I'm just picking you up on the small print, that's all.
No, WWE and WCW or whatever they call them, ECW.
ECW, you know yourself, don't act like you don't know.
Right, let's who's gonna so we did I think we did Jim, Flynn, me last time, so we'll continue with that rotation. So you take us away with your, so we've got 30 to get through, so no, we haven't actually, we've got a little bit less than 30, so it should be a little bit shorter episode. So you start us off, Jim.
Okay, so this is my 11th pick, and I'm gonna nominate Roger Bannister, who broke the record for running a mile in under 4 minutes on May 6, 1954. And a preemptive rebuttal to the obvious blue-haired objections is to point out that you could say the same about virtually any record in existence, which is to say that even though Roger Bannister is recognised as the guy to break the four-minute mile, you could probably safely say that there are a load of lads running just for water in Africa that could have absolutely spanked him at around the same time. But I will also say that we need to identify a standard. And as far as everyone's aware, Roger Bannister set that standard for middle distance running. So I'll pass it back over to you guys.
All right. So we may as well jump back into the criteria then. So was it an upset?
I would say, yeah. Not in terms of his opposition, but in terms of the record itself. Yeah, absolutely.
Was it talked about outside of the sport? I imagine it was, but do we know if it was?
I would say so. It's speculative, but I also think it was a pretty big deal. I'm sure people would be able to correct me.
Think the other two criteria, I think he's nailed them. Did it influence the future of the sport? Yeah, he was the first one to break that milestone to prove it could be done. And was it an achievement? Yeah, I'd say it was. What do you think, Biss? I think, could this be the top 10? What do you think, Biss?
It's got to be on the borderline, man. Because I do remember reading up a little bit about this a while ago. And they actually thought it was impossible, like scientifically impossible to break 4 minutes, you know what I mean? For the mile. So, and he did it just under. So, and obviously it's been broken how many times since. I'm not sure what the current record is, but it's probably in the lower end of the 3 minutes. I'm not sure exactly. I'm not even a hazard guess at what it is. I think Jim raises a good point. Like, had there been more scope for, you know, black athletes to be involved, perhaps he wouldn't have broke it, and he never would have held the record. You know, if there would have been a bit more diversity back then, which obviously there wasn't in the 50s. So I think he had a certain kind of like shoo-in in terms of, you know, him being a white man. I think he was a medical student from Oxford. So I think he's definitely got lucky in that respect. But basically on those terms, I probably wouldn't put it in the top 10. Do you know what I mean? We have to look at the whole sort of like landscape when it comes to deciding these. Impressive in its moment. Perhaps it doesn't hold up as much now. Shock factor definitely was there. What was the other criteria? Was he an underdog at that time? Hard to say.
I don't think running was really... I think it was in its embryonic stages in terms of, you know, now there's like an actual formula and people go to... There are recognized training methodologies for how you do it. I think back then people were basically just running as fast as they could or trying to figure it out as they went. I think even in like the 70s and 80s they were still doing that, whereas now I feel like there's a very definite scientific methodological edge to all types of running.
Yeah, and so just reading up on this, his record didn't stand for long at all. I'm not sure how long it did stand, but it wasn't long. And they're saying it was kind of the record continued to be lowered based on controlled climate and surface conditions, which kind of leads itself to say that the technology got better. So that kind of works in his favor as well, to be honest. More accurate timing devices, improvements in training and running techniques. So that's kind of, all of that for me is kind of working in his favor to say that, all right, it makes it a little bit more impressive. The fact that, you know, they started to develop things outside of the actual physical aspect of what he did to improve the chances of other people doing it. I mean, yeah, it'd be a close. It's a close one. Definitely in everyone's top 50, I think you have to say, in terms of its importance and its significance in the sport. But yeah, not in the top 10 for me.
I want it to be in the top 10. I'd vote for top 10, but I suppose it can only go in if we both agree.
It's very unsexy as a choice. That's my problem with it. It's not a very sexy choice. There are a lot of ones in here where it's like fucking nailed on highlight moments, material, 2 in the morning moments, you know, when you're just thinking of something to watch and you want to get goosebumps watching sports. Everything else in there is on that level. I'm not sure if Roger Bannister is.
Oh, we'll go with great quiz question. Something you need to know when it comes to sports trivia, but not in the top 10. Go on then, Finn, okay. Your one.
All right. Upper end of the maybe pile or something then. All right. So I'm going to go for my 11th pick for the Miracle on Ice. So what the Miracle on Ice was, it was when the US beat the Soviet Union in the 1980 Olympic hockey semifinal. So at the time, the Soviet Union or the USSR were a four-time defending gold medalist team, and they were heavily favored to take the whole tournament. Their team consisted primarily of professional players with significant experience in international play. By contrast, the United States team, led by head coach Herb Brooks, was composed mostly of amateur players, with only 4 players with minimal minor league experience. They were the youngest team in the tournament, and they were the youngest US national team in history. So we're talking about some college kids taking on like a well-oiled machine, like an absolute powerhouse. And at the end of the first period, they were tied at 2-2, but then the Soviets took a 3-2 lead in the second period. The US team, they scored 2 more goals to take the first lead midway through the third and final period, and they managed to hold on and win 4-3. So the group of kids did it. They smashed them. So that victory, it became one of the most iconic moments of the games and in US sports history ever. And that, just that bit's the Miracle on Ice, but they still needed to go and get the gold. So they still had to beat Finland. And at the end of the second period against Finland, the US were down 2-1. And there's a good story here. Apparently, during the second intermission, head coach Herb Brooks, who we mentioned earlier, he turned to the players and he said, "If you lose this game, you'll take it to your fucking graves." He then walked towards the locker room door, paused, looked over his shoulder and said to them again, "You're fucking Graves." And then they came back in the third period and they beat Finland 4-2 and got the gold. And in 1999, Sports Illustrated named this, the miracle on ice, the top sports moment of the 20th century.
Okay, for that final point, it's pretty much going to lead me into my main objection to this point. Now, I watched an ice hockey documentary about how when the Soviet Union fell apart, all the Russians were able to go to the NHL, play professionally for the first time, and how they basically leveled up the standard of the league. It was like, you know, German rocket scientists going into NASA, you know, all that kind of shit, like taking things to another level. But I also think it's wrapped up in a lot of the Cold War kind of pissing contest that was going on, which might afford it more importance. Based on your account, I feel like it's a massive achievement on the part of these young lads, especially when you've got a well-oiled team, as you say, that are used to winning things. But also, I don't know if it was the same members in the same squad for the Russians, or whether, like, say, they might have just got old, or, you know what I'm saying? Were there underlying factors? Because this seems like a very romanticized story.
Whether or not they were in the previous four Olympics that they won, the players were all professional and they all had significant experience in international play.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much like a sick one for the Yanks then, really. I didn't actually know this had ever happened. So is this an American-centric pick? I mean, Bissett might be a better place to comment on that.
I'd say in terms of American sports, I think it'd be up there. I've basically heard of it through through reading up on when I was searching for big moments in the US and stuff like that. This is one that cropped up very consistently. So I think 100% should be in the top 50. In terms of its importance in the sport, I suppose, once again, you can never discount things that happen in the Olympics. I think we sort of have, they are quite romanticized, aren't they? Things that happen in the Olympics. But we all know the Americans have a little bit of a penchant for, you know, making their sort of their sporting achievements seem better than they are. So I think there might be a little bit of that. I don't know, in terms of like the way it's been documented. I was just looking up. It was in Lake Placid as well, wasn't it? So it was in the US. I was looking at the attendance, 8,500 people. How much does that attribute to the importance of it? If 8,500 people wanted to be there, I don't know. Maybe the stadium only held that much and it was full capacity. I don't know. But it's just something that I picked up as I was going through. But going through the criteria, because I know you love to go through the criteria, Flynn. So sporting shock, absolutely. Huge shock by the sounds of it. Sporting achievement, yeah, has to be there, has to be considered because they went on to win the gold. Obviously, they beat the tournament favourites, probably a huge tournament favourite. Shock factor, yeah, absolutely has to be considered a shock factor. And what was the last? Well, I'm just doing these categories off the top of my head.
Influence
on the sport, I think you'd have to say 100% because the NHL is huge. I'm not sure how long the NHL has been around, but I would imagine this had, and I think you mentioned it earlier, that a lot of the Russians, would you say a lot of Russian hockey players came over to play in the US afterwards? Did you say after
that
this
was
event? Or?
After 91, so after the Iron Curtain fell, I think that's when it happened. But yeah, it just speaks to the quality of overall, like the Russian hockey game. So yeah, maybe the cultural bias is working in my favour. You make a promising case, Flynn.
And it's all going to be wrestling ones from me after this. So this is the best you're getting.
Overall, I'm leaning away from it, but it's more of, and I feel like this is happening a lot more in the list overall, is that we're now just getting down to what we prefer. The criteria are coming to me less and less, and I'm happy to admit that, really. It meets the criteria for me. It's just never crossed my mind as a big deal for sports before, and that's the only thing I can say against it.
Is it worth getting it into this top 10? Maybe the top 10 is bigger than the top 10 at the end and having the people vote. But, you know, because of all of our American and Russian fans.
Oh, yeah, it's not going to be in there at all, is it? People ain't going to pick it. Like, if we were going to put it out there to Americans, I think it would sneak in there in a top 10. But in terms of, like, Europeans, like, nah, they ain't going to respect it, are they? They ain't going to give it any respect.
The 300 million people in Russia and all the Nordic people.
Ireland, 5 million. Russia, 350 million.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm definitely in the top 50, like absolutely nailed on for a top 50. But nah, I'm going to lean to say nah, not for a top 10.
And in the interest of expediency, I don't think it deserves a yellow, but I'm happy to put it on the maybe pile. Sorry,
the maybe Kyle.
The maybe cut. Hey, maybe cat. Yeah, the maybe pile. Are we happy with right. that? Happy enough?
To the maybe pile it goes.
All right, I'll do mine. I've got a footy one. So this is the kind of last 10 minutes of the Man City versus QPR game in, was it 2012? So when they needed to clinch their first ever Premier League title and snatch it from their hands of their old dominant neighbours that had cast them into the shadows for far too long. 44 years of waiting for that title, for it to be in their own hands before the game, and everyone to expect them to do the business and to see it slipping away in the final moments as they were losing 2-1. And then they had the Joey Barton madness throughout the game. They had Paddy Kenny with absolute heroics stopping everything. And then obviously you had Balotelli, and then you had Aguero. And I swear you'll never see anything like this again. Great sporting moment, capped off with the classic Martin Tyler. Absolutely huge moment. And it's one of those footy moments that I will always remember where I was. And I think if you asked like all of our listeners where you were when you saw that, when that moment happened, they would be able to tell you. And I think that resonates very, very highly in terms of a great sporting moment. What do you think, lads?
It was a definite ball tingler. I absolutely remember where I was. I was in my bedroom, just skinning up my second spliff of the day. And I was thinking, okay, it was actually down to the last day as well, wasn't it? Because Man United, I can't remember who they were playing, but they finished their game thinking they'd won the league. And then this late drama came, as you said, ironically, basically Fergie time for the citizens. I'm not sure how much of an upset this was.
So when I was doing my research for making a list for this episode and the previous episode, this was a moment that came up a lot with people I asked. It's kind of hard to not put it in the top 10. Let's just try and shake down the old criteria. Jim, you didn't reckon it was an upset?
No, not at all.
And Bissett, would you be able to argue for it being an upset?
I would argue that it's an upset in the moment that when they were 2-1 down, that a huge upset. They were 2-1 down with 3 minutes left to go. Do you know what I mean? And they need to win because United beat Sunderland, I believe, 1-0. And that game had finished. And I think the players and the coaching staff might have started to catch word. Apparently, I think Mancini didn't sort of relay the information to his players, but there was kind of murmurings around in the crowd that he'd finished 1-0. So they had to win. Or it might have been a draw. I can't remember what it was. And I think it was in their own hands. So if they won, no matter what United did, they would have won the Premier League. So that's the only argument I'd have. In that moment, you know, potentially it was an upset because they would have been huge underdogs with 3 minutes left to go, 2-1 down.
I think definitely shocking. I don't know if it's being a bit pedantic and just splitting hairs, but I would stop short of calling that an upset because Stoke were like anybody's really basically existing in the league. And I know
QPR.
QPR, yeah, even worse than really.
They were safe on goal difference prior to the game. So there was no chance of them being relegated. So there was nothing for them. There was nothing on the game, really. There was kind of like they had no pressure on them whatsoever. Do you know what I mean? It probably would have made the circumstances different had there been a bit of pressure. But I think that kind of led it to their sort of like balls to the wall. Let's just go out and, you know, sort of like have a game of football. Maybe perhaps stop a team from winning the league. I think they probably would have liked that in a way. But it was a massive shock for them to go 2-1 up. Remember, Jamie Mackie scored the second. And then obviously you just saw the Man City fans were just like their head in their hands. Just like, I think there was people leaving the stadium. There was like people in tears. So it was a huge moment really for it to flip on its head.
I want to go talk to you about the influence. Did it influence the future of the sport? And I think maybe it did, but maybe not in such a positive way. Because we often, you especially on this podcast, like to rant about money and football. And this is definitely a defining moment in that story. What do you reckon about that?
Yeah, huge, because it was Man City's first ever title. Obviously, they got took over by Sheikh Mansour. I want to say it was 4 or 5 years, might have even been 6 years prior to this. It might have been 2006, 2007, maybe. Obviously, when they started signing like the classic Brazilian players like Robinho and Joe and Elano and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think this was a massive kind of moment in terms of, well, obviously Chelsea had done it in the past, like in what the Abramovich era, he pumped money in prior to this. You know, there was a lot of clubs. Blackburn, I think, were the first, one of the first teams that sort of bought the league. They bought Alan Shearer, Chris Sutton when they won it in what, 95, 96. So it's been happening for a long time under the Premier League era, ever since, you know, the sort of like massive money came in from Sky and they brokered that deal, and it just become this sort of monopolization of the game. So I don't want that to sort of like take off any sort of impact of them winning it after, you know, 44 years of waiting for a first division title. But you're right in saying that it didn't have a positive influence, because now we've got teams like Newcastle that are owned by, you know, the Saudi state, who are doing all sorts of stuff in other sports, by the way. They're basically trying to, not corrupt, but it is essentially corrupting golfers with money by trying to drag them in a Super League. Apparently, Bryce DeChambeau has been offered 100 million, besides the point. But the fact is, you're right in terms of it sort of like, you know, having a sort of bad impression of how to sort of go and win a league. And it's not the same as another one that I'm going to bring up later, another team winning that Premier League title, which is kind of a complete contrast.
Yeah, I think we all know the one you're going to bring up. For me, this can't go in the top 10. Great moment. One of my favourite footballing moments of all time, for sure. I caught it live, a rarity for me at the time. Yeah, massive shock within the context of the game. But I think City, whether it was that year or the next, that title was coming, man. And also to support your point there, Bissett, it's unfair to level the accusation at Man City that they were the progenitors of big money in football, because you even look at Alex Ferguson. He broke the British transfer record in his tenure at United more than any other club, more than any other manager, and he's the most successful of all time. So money's always got a part to play. It's just now it's got to ridiculous, scandalous levels. So yeah, not for me, but a great moment, a good choice. Miss it.
I would have been leaning towards putting it in the top 10 only because so many people have mentioned it to me in the week leading up to this episode, but I'm going to stick with Jim on this one. Maybe pilot.
All right,
booking
cool.
It. Yep. Maybe pilot.
All right, sounds good. Next one then, Jim.
Okay, my 12th choice. I think this is going to split some hairs. So this is Conor McGregor versus Floyd Mayweather, the 26th of August, 2017. Now, similar to Flynn's choice, or similar to Bissett's choice, but Flynn's opinion on it, I've never witnessed a fight being talked about as often as this one was in my whole life. Now, the build-up was an actual circus. They did a multi-city press tour that was basically a double act between the two fighters, and it was everywhere. It also gave birth to this latest wave of freak show fights that pissed Tino off so much. Hello, Tino. And it was the highest-selling combat sports pay-per-view of all time, ahead of Mayweather's clash with Manny Pacquiao. McGregor even kept the dream alive until the end of the first round when he landed a good uppercut on Floyd's chin. Could it be? Well, no. In the end, Mayweather drowned him, but I'm nominating this as an event, not really as a sporting contest or a fight. So over to you two.
And you have just alluded to exactly what I've just written down in my notes. Like, we're talking about, we've called it the greatest moments. And for me, that resembles the fact it should be synonymous with great achievements. So greatest for me is greatest achievements. That would be the sort of word I'd put after that. So you're bang on in what you just said in terms of its kind of like popularity. And I remember people that were not into sports at all that were talking about it. That were sort of saying to me, oh, you're watching the fight on the weekend. It's like, yeah, probably will do, to be fair. Like, but, you know, obviously to sports fans, it didn't feel like that much of an event. It was kind of like everyone was rolling their eyes at it. But in terms of his impact on the sport, and obviously on McGregor's impact financially, like the amount of money he's made from sort of like that fight and then obviously gone on to make with his UFC past and prior to that, you know, it just can't be ignored. Would have put it in a greatest 50. It's definitely not getting in the top 10 for me. I'm actually going to yellow card it. I'm considering whether it would get into a top 50 greatest sporting moments. Not, I think this is the wrong sort of, it's the wrong category for it, but it's just not, no, it's not for me. I can't put it anywhere near a top 10. It's going to be a yellow card for me.
You wound me, Bissett. You wound my soul.
I think it's a really interesting choice because both of those men have some amazing achievements in their careers. Amazing moments, which I don't think any of us are going to bring up, unfortunately. Conor McGregor, first two-time champ or first two-weight division champ in the UFC, knocking out Jose Aldo in how many seconds, Jim?
13.
And was he undefeated for how many years?
About a decade, I think.
Yeah, like, Conor McGregor's had some amazing moments, but I like the rationale behind this. And part of these, I do understand what Bissett says. At the time, sports fans were rolling their eyes, and it would be weird for us as a sports podcast to put this in the top 10. But part of me the rebellious part of me, not the company man bit, is feeling like whacking it in there.
You know, it's like putting Frankel up against Bret Hart. Both of them have legitimate achievements within their own right, within their own sports or sports entertainment industry. And it's like putting them two up against, you can't consider their achievements within their own sports. Do you know what I mean? It was a circus, man. And all the sort of like exhibition fights that have happened after this are that as such. Sporting, for me, sport will always be about meritocracy and achievement based on, you know, based on the efforts that you put into it. This was just a money grab, like, essentially, wasn't it? So I cannot put it anywhere near a great sporting moment on those sort of terms, really.
I actually think it was a genuine sporting contest. And there's a reason I think that is because of the mammoth egos of both men involved. Now, by all accounts, Floyd didn't really train that hard for this fight, which tells you what you need to know. McGregor was basically trying to level up a subpar skill set against one of the greatest boxers of all time. He still managed to go 10 rounds, but I'll have to concede, Bissett, that I don't think sport is a meritocracy or even should be a meritocracy all the time. But I completely understand that on a competitive level, if McGregor would have won, this would have been a massive moment. But as it went down, it was rather predictable after the freak show had ended. So I'm happy with wherever you want to put it.
You've just talked me out of wanting it to be in the top 10 there. If McGregor would have won, top 10, 100%. Yeah. This would be a top 10 moment.
I would be fighting tooth and nail for it to be included in the top 10 if McGregor won. But as it stands, yeah, I'm happy. I'm happy.
Very good. Very good point, because I think it would have had the shock factor. It would have had the underdog factor. So, yeah, a good candidate for getting into the top 10, because based on the fact that it would have been a huge upset for him to go and beat Mayweather. But because that didn't happen, and sometimes these sporting events get set up because they want to have that sporting shock. They want to have that big sporting moment. The fact that it didn't happen, perhaps, yeah, almost solidifies the fact that it can't be in the top 10. Had it swung the other way and McGregor won, then I think it might have been a candidate. But based on that, I don't think we can put it in there. So I think we should probably move on to the next one.
We got to book it.
I think we got to book it both.
I went to the toilet and you two have conspired. Let me just take these daggers.
Double yellowed, mate. Now. Double yellowed. So that one's out of here.
Nah, fair's.
All right, go on then. Who's next? Flynn?
All right, yeah, I think I'm up next.
Ready for another story?
This one's a hell of a story. I like this one. So I want to talk. So my next point is Mankind versus the Undertaker.
Mankind versus who?
So my next point is Mankind versus the Undertaker in the Hell in a Cell.
I know it well, Flynn. Go on, carry on.
Right. Next point, Mankind versus The Undertaker in the Hell in a Cell. This was huge. It was the third Hell in a Cell match in history, and it took place at the King of the Ring pay-per-view on June the 28th, 1998. Now, for any of our listeners out there who don't know what a Hell in a Cell match is, first of all, where have you been all your life? But what it is, it involves enclosing the ring within a 16-foot-high steel cage with a roof. Now, the match is notable for two reasons. Number one, Undertaker threw Mankind from the top of the cage through the announcer's table. So that's a 16-foot drop, or it's like 5 meters more or less. It's huge. And number two, Undertaker choke slammed Mankind whilst on top of the roof of the cage, and he unintentionally smashed him through the roof of the cage and he plummeted straight down onto the canvas. And this was an accident. This one wasn't scripted. The match was almost stopped twice after both of those incidents, but Mankind insisted that they carry on. It took a severe physical toll on his body in the long term, and eventually became the match that he's most remembered for following his retirement in the year 2000. The match received instant critical acclaim from the wrestling media and is widely regarded as a classic match in the careers of both wrestlers, as well as one of the greatest and most important Hell in a Cell matches and wrestling matches in general. What do we think about that, Bissett?
You're not going to bait me into these red cards. And I know that Jim's got more respect for himself and the sporting world than to not give that a booking. So that's my piece.
I have zero respect for the sporting world. And to be fair, it's almost unfair to ask me to do that, because this is a true story. I scoured the markets of Birmingham looking for a videotape of this match and of this event. I was obsessed with it. It was part of the introduction for SmackDown And I was thinking, I need to see that whole thing rather than just a highlight clip. And I'll watch that shit over and over and over again. It's hard for me to discount this. It was such a massive part of my early sporting life. You know, so this, I can't dismiss it out of hand. I really can't.
Good man, Jim.
So it's going to work. It's going to get you wouldn't put that in the top 50 greatest sporting moments. Come on.
Why not? You could easily. Yeah. It was huge. Like Jim said, people around our age, our early 30s, we were informative, like childhood years there before you get into more actual combat sports. This was a huge formative moment. It was a huge moment for sport in general. This was.
You know what? And that's the actual truth for me. Like, I know it's semi-winding you up here, but I think it's impossible to ignore the parallels between wrestling and boxing. And I've said it before on the pod, half-naked geezers touching each other. It's various extents of that, isn't it? So I took a lot of that and took it onto UFC, MMA in general, and boxing. So it really is difficult for me to say that this is not, at least should be up for consideration. Do you know what I mean? I dismiss it out of hand. Poor form, is it? I reckon. You selected a horse before, though.
But at least in horse racing, the winner isn't predetermined. Like, and all the sports we've been talking about, the winner is not predetermined. And no matter what happens during that wrestling match, you know, there has always been a predetermined winner. And that for me is why I cannot even, it should even not be accepted into a sporting moment. It shouldn't even be accepted as a sport.
Well, let me remind you that you've used your one and only red card so far for probably the only wrestling match in history that wasn't predetermined.
Yeah, the last one, yeah.
So that solidifies what, you know, I'm not being baited into red cards, yellow cards, and do whatever you want with it, but it's not getting into a top 10.
Just to get back to the predetermined thing. Yeah, sure, the winners are predetermined, but it's based on sportsmanship. It's they don't decide. Vince McMahon or the boss of whichever wrestling company doesn't decide you're going to be popular. You have to have that charismatic energy about you. You need to have that athleticism about you. You need to be an entertainer and a sportsman to do well in these sports. There is a certain degree of meritocracy in there, I'd argue.
Yeah, you can argue it all you want, really. Yeah, that's fine. But it's not getting in the top 10. That's it. Should we move on or what?
It's not getting a yellow card from me, man. Absolutely. Where's it go?
Top end of the maybe pile?
Somewhere.
Yeah?
I'd say probably at the very top. The very top of the maybe pile for variety.
Can't believe what I'm hearing.
So anyway, it could be a wild card. We can have the listeners vote whether it can go into the top 10.
All right, we'll put it on there. All right, we'll put it on there as a wild card. All right, I'll do my number 12. So this is Super Bowl 2017 and the greatest comeback of all time in the sport, in the biggest moment of all time in the sport. So the biggest event every year, which is the Super Bowl, the culmination of the two best teams from either division. So the Patriots were down 28-3 to the Falcons near the end of the third quarter. So they probably had just over 15 minutes, which in terms of American football isn't a long time, especially when you've got a 25-point deficit. And then up stepped Tom Brady, who deserves a memorable a moment of respect because he's retired recently. And the rest was history. And he nearly did it again on the weekend against the Rams as well. I think they were down 23, or it might have been a similar score. It might have been 27-3. This is in his last game since he retired. At the ripe old age of 44, nearly did it again. You can't keep a good dog down, by and large, makes it, you know, one of the biggest shocks in sort of sporting history. So there you go.
In terms of, again, we're kind of retreading the ground as in the QPR Man City game, aren't we? An upset within the confines of the game. The Falcons hadn't won, my beloved Atlanta Falcons, hadn't won a Super Bowl since the 1998 season. But I do remember them being at the forefront of the kind of wider NFL conversation. You know yourself, I'm not like a fan, but it was one of those things that would pop up on Sky Sports News kind of during the period where they're telling you about the Super Bowl and that, and that they were pretty present throughout that period. So am I right in saying they were a fairly decent team?
Yeah, decent team. Obviously, Matt Ryan, their longstanding quarterbacks, was there. Patriots were 14-2 over the season, though, whereas the Falcons were 11-5. So a Falcons going into that Super Bowl would have probably been, or prior to the playoffs, they probably would have been one of the outsiders based on their regular season record, whereas Patriots would have almost certainly been the favourites. So it was kind of like the favourites were about to be slain, do you know what I mean? And then obviously up steps Tom Brady, the old sort of like redeemer, comes and just scores like 25 points, brings them like back from the death, basically. So it was not only a great moment in its own right, but also it added to sort of Brady's legacy.
And what do you prefer, this game or this moment, or when he won it with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers?
That's a good point, because we can't put two Tom Brady moments in there, really.
As much as I'd like to, like,
I mean, even if we just put Tom Brady's career as a sports person in there, if we just want to merge both of them, if we can put a career as a sports person in there, I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, but the Tiger Woods thing, like that, innit? Like, it was difficult to identify the actual moment, kind of. He's not in there, but he certainly should be if we're going to start introducing those kind of parameters to the conversation. So
yeah, so we said that Tiger Woods, that was a start of his legacy, wasn't it? So all right, we'll keep the Brady one, winning it with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, in there, because that was kind of like the culmination of his legacy. That was the rounding up of his like awesome career, because he went from a team, as we said, that where he was at the Pats for like 19-20 years under Bill Belichick, created sort of one of the sort of best sporting dynasties you'll see in any sport in terms of, like, you know, their achievements. And then he went to an entirely new team, like brought Rob Gronkowski with him, but still managed to sort of win a title for a team that hadn't won in, what, 17, 18 years. So we'll keep the original one in there. And in terms of a sporting shock, this is up there. It'd definitely be in terms of sporting shocks within, as you say, within the right of the game. But yeah, I'm happy for it perhaps not to be included in the top 10, but I think it certainly would be in the top 50.
I agree with that. You asked the question I was thinking about asking. Are we going to have two similar Tom Brady moments in the top 10? And nah, we'll keep the one we've got. And we'll just leave this one for now.
Yeah, I think the Tampa Bay example is a much better demonstration of his prowess as a player, to be honest. As you say, any young buck can fucking lift the Super Bowl. Well, not any, I'm being facetious there. But, you know, when you're in the prime of your life, you've got way more of a chance of doing it.
Nick Foles, who won the Super Bowl with the Eagles, I think might have been 2019. He'd only played about four games with them, because Carson Wentz had been leading the team throughout the whole season. He got injured, I want to say, four or five games. It might have been sort of one game before the playoffs or in the playoffs. Nick Foles came in and he was really good. He led that team, a very experienced player, been around the league for a long time. And he was a Super Bowl MVP that year. So he was sort of like not a great quarterback, bit of a journeyman, backup quarterback. But then he came in, won the Super Bowl, won the MVP. And then he came to Chicago Bears and he was just poor, really, really poor. Just could not deal, like couldn't adjust to a new team. So in that respect, it kind of, that makes what Tom Brady did like even more sort of miraculous, really. So I think we'll keep that original one in, skip this one out, and then we'll go to your next one.
All right, nice. Can't fault your rationale there. For my number 13 pick, I'm going to nominate Mike Powell, setting the long jump world record of 8.95 meters on the 30th of August, 1991, at the Athletics World Championships in Tokyo. He broke Bob Beamon's 23-year-old record by 5 centimeters in a shootout with the great and sneaky Carl Lewis, which adds some big game player credentials to this incredible athletic feat. It's a pretty simple one. I think it should be up for serious consideration.
I mean, we've talked a lot about the sexy spots in these two episodes. We may have found the least sexy of the lot.
the duel between Powell and Carl Lewis, it's actually epic, man. If you watch the highlights of it, it's fucking sick. And Carl Lewis is here. He's only 3 years removed from becoming the beneficiary of a witch hunt against Ben Johnson in the Seoul Olympics in 1988. Yeah, basically the poster boy of the American mega machine, the commercial athletic enterprise. And he just got outdone by a superior guy who managed to hold his nerve on the biggest stage, or by the Olympics, actually. This is the World Athletic Championship. So I'd say this was absolutely an upset. Is it along the same lines as the Fosbury flop? No, he didn't invent any new techniques. I think he basically just gained as many inches as he could through various, you know, pardon the pun. Was it a shock? I'd say it was a shock. Definitely an upset against Carl Lewis, for sure. So, yeah, I think it meets the criteria. But again,
interests outside of the sport?
I'm going to presume, it's hard to say, man. 91, the year I was born, hasn't exactly rippled through time towards us. I'm just aware of it because of, you know, sports trivia reasons, but it's hard to say contemporarily.
I like it, but like Bissett often says, we can't put that anywhere near the top 10, I don't think. What do you think?
Often.
To me.
Yeah, only to Flynn. Now, I'll probably have to say it to Jim as well. I think this is going to have to get a yeller. I think it's difficult when it comes to the Olympics and sort of individual sports. It has to be something groundbreaking. It has to be something really, really unique, and it has to set like a huge precedent in the sport. Obviously, world records get beat every single year, like multiple world records get beat at the Olympics. This was at the World Championships, wasn't it, in Tokyo? So it wasn't even the Olympics, not even the highest stage of the athletics world.
This record still stands today. So
good point. I didn't clock that when you. I don't know if you said that earlier, but that changes things. But yeah, I don't want to say like I don't want it to be a popularity contest, but the popularity of the sport and the popularity of the moment does it do enough for me.
It's a factor.
Yeah, it doesn't really do enough for me to get into a top 10. So yeah, I can't not book it really.
I was gonna book it. It wasn't doing it for me, but that's a 30-year-old record, a 31-year-old record.
Yeah.
Wow. That's almost top 10 material. That.
And he broke a 23-year-old record.
That's incredible. That's an incredible achievement. It smashes that criteria.
This sport has been moving forward incrementally for the last half a century, and he's the last guy to move the needle.
This is the only thing that I would say, I suppose, give context. We were talking about the use of technology and the development of techniques and training techniques, et cetera, and how you can be advanced or advance those facets of the game to make sure you improve the level skill level, what you put into it. With a long jump, how much technology and sort of training can you do to improve that technique? Do you know what I mean? That's the only reason that I'm saying maybe that world record stood for that many years. Perhaps it is just down to like he's the best at what he did and no one's been physically up to his standard. So it kind of, that might give some pros and cons to it, but I think maybe you'd get into a top 50 based on that. Once again, not a top 10, so I think my yellow card's going to stand.
I would be remiss to yellow something like that. So I'd have to say top end of the main something like that. It's an awesome one.
There's disharmony on the committee.
I want to talk about Kathy Freeman. At the 1994 Commonwealth Games, Kathy caused controversy. She won the 200-meter sprint, yeah? She's Aboriginal Australian, yeah? She caused controversy when she did her victory lap, she carried both the Australian national flag and the Aboriginal flag as well.
Ooh,
it pissed some people off at the time. I've got some quotes for you. So at the time, the Aboriginal flag was not recognised as an official Australian flag, so officially she wasn't allowed to do it. Later on in her autobiography, she said, "I wanted to shout, look at me, look at my skin, I'm black and I'm the best. There was no more shame." Now, the day after this victory lap, Australia's chef de mission, or mission chief of the games, Arthur Tunstall, said, "She should have carried the Australian flag first up and we should not have even seen the Aboriginal flag at all." So 2 days later, she won the, I think it was the 400-meter sprint. I'd have to double check. And again, in defiance, she tied both of the flags together and ran the victory lap again. And the story didn't end there. Just 6 years later, Kathy then became the first Aboriginal Australian person to win an Olympic gold medal. She won the gold medal in the 400-meter sprint at the 2000 Olympic Games. And again, she carried both flags during the victory lap. But this time, that very same act was seen as a moment for the nation, symbolising the Australian people's desire for reconciliation and pride in her Aboriginal cultural heritage.
That was in Sydney as well, wasn't it? The 2000 Olympics.
That's right. She was the one who lit the torch.
You know what? There's a lot of emotional moments in there, you know. I feel like we've got an inadequate set of criteria in here. You know what I mean? It's on par with Jesse Owens, really. If you think about like rabbit proof fence and all that, man, it's fucking horrible shit going on over there in Australia. Part of like basically our fault, the imperial dream lives on. I like it. The fact that she was like, yeah, fuck that. I'm definitely carrying this 2 days later when I win. I like her. In terms of the sporting achievement, where did we sit? Was she like top three performer consistently?
Yeah, she's elite. Yeah, there was no upsets about her winning. She was elite.
And in terms of, yeah, I think we're going down the... Yeah, sorry, go on.
Achievement-wise, huge achievement. First Aboriginal Australian person to get an individual gold medals. But yeah, she did smash most.
And even that kind of sinks into a grey area. There have been other Aboriginal descendants who had won other things, but maybe in team events. Is that what you're implying?
I believe that's the case, yeah. The stat that I found about her said she's the first Aboriginal Australian to win an individual medal, so...
Yeah, I like her as a person. I like her defiance. I like her achievements. It's sliding away with everything we're talking about here. I don't know if I can include it. I think I'm going to yellow card it, but not out of any dislike towards it. It's just that I don't think it belongs.
I was actually leaning towards this being a contender, man, to be honest, the way he was describing it. It doesn't instantly jump out at me in my memory. But I think moments like this deserve to be put into a category of talking about great sporting moments, because obviously we know about how sports can be defiled by politics and by race, racial tensions, etc., etc. And the fact that you've got athletes that are at the top of the game, which is the Olympics. Obviously, she's won 4 golds Commonwealth Games. She won that gold in Sydney, 2 golds in the World Championships. Obviously, at the top of her sport. 16 years old, she won, I think, the gold medal in when she was in the Commonwealth Games, which adds to the kind of like, you know, stepping up to that, you know, the moment at such a young age and then continuing her sort of sporting achievements throughout her career. And then also having the absolute bollocks to stand up to the racists of this world. That's why it's kind of I'm leaning towards it, man. That's the only thing that's giving it to me as a whole package. That feels like it does feel like a great moment. I don't know, it should be considered. I'm definitely not going to yellow it anyway.
Are we nominating because the six when she's 16, did she win a gold when she was 16? Yeah,
I believe that was a case. The 1994 Commonwealth Games, I think I'd have to double check.
Sorry to put you on the spot there.
Yeah. It's not so much about her winning the medals. It's more about this act of defiance with the moment of the flags and then them telling her not to do it. And she still did it. Then she did it again. But the second time she did it, it was for peace and harmony. Do you know what I mean? You know what?
That's my favorite part of this story. But also, there wasn't that many years separating how that gesture was interpreted by people at large. And that suggests to me that it was just the media reframing it. She did the same thing and she sounds like she was the same person. So now Rupert Murdoch and the boys get to tell you how to feel about something and we get goosebumps. I don't like that, man. I don't like that as a general vibe. It's not her fault. And I would say it's very similar to the Jesse Owens moment, other than the fact that Jesse Owens disproved the white supremacy theory of the Nazis. I think it's more of an upset on that level.
But does her having that defiance initially, so Kathy Freeman, you know, holding the two flags up and the media attention that it brought, and then the sort of subsequent sort of, I guess it sort of would have been vilified the way it was treated. Did that not bring about that second view on it? You know, the sort of, the media change on it, the media twist on it. So in terms of it's kind of like bringing its attention and sort of and really focusing people's attention in that way, it kind of that makes it kind of significant, doesn't it?
I would be very surprised if it wasn't a contributing factor towards that change in attitude, definitely. Mm-hmm. But it's just maybe it's that poked a little sore spot with me because I don't like being told how to feel about things. And that's what that highlights to me. But again, I'm not saying it definitely doesn't belong in the top 10. Well, I did say that, but I'm not saying it's like, oh, that's a shit choice. I think it's as worthy as any other choice, really. But for me, I'm just leaning away and I don't find myself softening to it as much as I want to, because she sounds like fucking top class bird. Like, do you know what I mean? Fuck you. Like, I'll flow whatever flags I want. But based on the fact that she was basically top dog as well, I'm leaning away.
Fair enough. So we'll have to put it in the maybe pile then, I suppose. The maybe never to be included pile, I suppose. Are we going? Because Jim didn't like it.
That was fucking... That was some Rupert Murdoch fucking witchcraft right there. Jim doesn't like it, doesn't make it in. Is it Murdoch, man? Slack.
All right, so I'll do my number 13. So, and I hate to be the subject of recency bias, but you would have to include, especially in the top 50, I would assume, the final lap of last year's Grand Prix in Abu Dhabi. And it's one of those moments in sport that will probably be spoken about for decades to come. Do you know what I mean? I think in 20 years, it will be considered like a great sporting moment, because I think we are sort of prone to not include things that have recently happened. Because we're like, oh, it can't be great because it didn't happen 20, 30 years ago. Do you know what I mean? But the controversy, the drama, the elite level of driving, and it all happened on the last Grand Prix of the season when everything was on the line between the two drivers that were going in for the title, which was Hamilton and Max Verstappen. Whichever side you sit on the regarding race director Mazzi's decision, it created pure sporting drama and one that surely piqued the interest of millions of new fans with the season just a couple of months away. So I think it has to be considered for a top 50. I think it's absolutely nailed on in terms of like a moment within its own right in the sport. Obviously, you know, Formula One is a huge sport and I think it's very, very popular around the globe. For me, I was never that into it. Do you know what I mean? So, and it's, I think it's going to be one of them. I think I'll probably remember where I was in 20 years, like when this was happening and sort of like the sheer sort of like puzzlement on people's faces and they couldn't believe it really. So I think it's going to be a tough sell to get in the top 10. But if you go through the criteria, I think it probably hits all the criteria. But I definitely be in the top 50, but we'll see what you two think.
I love this one. I'm happy for this to go in the top 10. This is one of my favorite out of all the episodes I've done on the podcast with you guys. This was one of my favorite ones to research. The more I learned about it, the more interesting I found it. Basically, the race director, if my memory serves correctly, look, he just had a kingmaker's decision to make, basically. I let the race go this way, he wins. I make this decision, he wins. And he went for that decision. He went for the exciting, what would be the more exciting one. And he kind of had his hands tied. And I thought it was just quite interesting. Let's see, does it meet all the criteria? It was definitely an upset. did it create general interest outside the sport? Definitely. Did it influence the future of the sport? I imagine there'll be some talks about the role of the race directors from now on. I imagine, but I don't know that for a fact. Was it an achievement? Yeah, so Verstappen stopped Hamilton getting his 8th Grand Prix win. Am I right there? Was that?
Yeah, that's right. Right? Yep.
Well, for me, I love this one. I think this one was brilliant. I'm happy for that to go in the top 10.
I think in terms of the timing, last lap, last race of a closely contested championship, I don't think you can get much better than that. In terms of timing, it's probably better than the Man City QPR one for me. Obviously, like football bias, etc., etc. But what you've just outlined there, the race director Massey, you're right. Kingmaker's decision, perfect way to put it. And I actually think he made the right decision in terms of general interest in the sport, how to create that moment. But I also think that such an important, pivotal moment being left up to someone basically flipping a coin, I think it devalues it. In terms of everything else, especially going against Hamilton, because Hamilton is an all-time number one top dog, man. Do you know what I mean? And to beat him in any kind of circumstance is sick. But to have it up in the air like that and someone make a decision that's not exactly arbitrary, but is made concerning factors that is not basically down to the letter of the law in the sport, kind of puts it out there for me. It's hovering around the top 10 for me still, regardless of all that, but that might push it out there for me.
I think that's a great breakdown of it. I think that is the deciding factor, that the race director, you know, he changed the path. You know, he changed the course of history in that moment. It probably wouldn't have been exciting, nowhere near as exciting, and it probably wouldn't have generated as much interest from other sources, from outside of the sport, if he would have left it to finish in a way where Hamilton finished behind the emergency car. Is it the emergency car they call it? The safety car. Yeah, so if Hamilton would have finished behind the safety car, it definitely wouldn't have been sort of talked about, like in terms of it being a great moment in the sport. But it would have been the fairest way to do it in terms of, like, you know, the fact that Hamilton was, how many seconds ahead was he? I think he was 12 seconds ahead or something before the crash. But the argument would be from, I think, Formula One fans, is that that's an aspect of the sport that you just have to deal with. Do you know what I mean? It's a part of the sport that happens. You know, sometimes you get that sort of unlucky break where you're 12 seconds ahead a crash happens. And then, you know, he set up this final lap. He made this decision, a very, very controversial decision. So in both ways, I'm happy if it doesn't get in the top 10. I'm happy if it does, to be honest. But I think Jim makes a great point.
Controversial decision, but not an illegal one within the rules.
I don't think it's illegal. Honestly, I've got no problem with Massey having that scope as the race director. I really don't. I mean, how often do we see big football games decided by a one-off penalty decision, even with VAR now? It's a similar kind of thing, to be honest. In football, they're too numerous to count, and that's why they don't get highlighted as much, because you just think, fuck it, I don't want to talk about it. But with this, because it was such a one-off and because the microscope was well and truly on it, it's emphasised a lot more. I have no problem with it being, again, we've been referencing this top 50 that we're not going to make, but yeah, it's literally probably 11, 12, 13 on my list, if not number 10. So just race director's Massey's involvement in the result is all that's kicking it away for me.
For me, that's what makes it the great controversial big moment. That's what makes it exciting, that little bit of controversy. That's why I'd put it in the top 10. Like you, lower end of the top 10, but I'd put it in there.
It's got to be a strong maybe then, isn't it? Going into the sort of...
Strong maybe.
Yeah.
I've only got one or two strong maybes. There's not many. There's a load of maybes, but there's probably... On the list I've been keeping anyway, there's only one or two. So that's worth consideration once we either revise this list or put it up for public vote for our 18 fans up the boys. Okay, so that is that background to me now? Okay, yep. So for my 14th pick, let's go back to 1991, a serendipitous year, the year of my birth, and the year Lee Haney won his 8th Mr. Olympia title, breaking the record set by Arnold Schwarzenegger in 1980. Now, as we are all obviously aware, Ronnie Coleman would tie the record in 2005. In a run that would change the sport forever. But Haney is the first to get that 8th title. Now, I'm sure you guys are buzzing about this. What do you think?
Top 10, 100%, no questions asked.
Yeah, I think so.
Case closed.
Absolute disgusting power crunch you two are. I'm not even going to fucking... Achievement within sport, innit? That's weighed up what it is, for what it is. You know what I mean? What tie the record. Somebody went on to get more titles than him. Did you say Ronnie Coleman?
Ronnie Coleman went to tie the record for 8, and he did it in a straight run, which is arguably more, well, kind of hard, isn't it? You've got a physical peak and all that. There's only so many steroids you can eat in a day. But yeah, I think this is actually, no mess about, yeah. I think the main disagreement to be had about this is whether you can consider bodybuilding a sport. But even then, I think it's got legitimate cause to be at least considered. I actually do.
Not in a top 10, though, surely. Like, maybe you could consider it for a top 50.
I don't know. All time Mr. Olympia titles. This is the zenith of the bodybuilding world, man.
Yeah, but once again, you have to weigh up the popularity of the sport that we're talking about.
Bodybuilding is really popular, man. Especially on my YouTube feeds.
I think it's one of the dudes like Plato or Socrates said, is like a man who never gets to... who never once in his life gets to the point of his peak performance and peak body type has not lived a full life. And Plato and the boys knew a bit about life.
They loved a bit of bombing, though, as well, to be fair.
And
lots of people
having
do.
Sex with six-year-old boys. So I'm not sure how much they're... Didn't Plato or Socrates actually said the purest love is between a man and a child, a boy child as well, or something along those lines. I think you have to discredit the Greek philosophers on that one.
You always hear about these Roman leaders who like had like the most amazing wife in Rome and then fell in love with some like boy.
Oh no! Even Harkonnen in June love boys, isn't it? Oh, it's nay, just sprinkled throughout history. You know, man.
But nah, it's getting a yellow from me. So up to you, Flint.
I can't yellow, Mr. Olympia, 8 times in a row. Let's hit the criteria. Upset?
I don't think you consider it an upset because he was actually similar to our calf, the Aboriginal. He was at the zenith for the sport. He was at the peak, man.
Achievement: he beat Arnie's record of 7.
Yep, I think that's a great achievement.
So I remember reading Arnie's 7th one is a bit controversial because it was maybe more to do with his fame as a movie star.
That was actually me bringing that up on the podcast, mate. Don't know about you reading it. Yeah. It reminded me of that time that Arnold Schwarzenegger did. That was that bit there. But yeah, genuine. So this man did it without the peripheral influences of a Hollywood career to do it, which I think makes it more impressive.
And interest outside of the sport, no doubt.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did he influence the future?
Oh, we know. We all know about it.
No, listen. Miss it. I've actually like read a few books about this man, and it's all to do with like proportions of the body. And there's guys like Frank Zane who are like these thinner, more athletic types. Arnie was the fucking chiseled Adonis type. And like now you get these super fucking mutant freaks where their dimensions aren't quite as aesthetically pleasing. They're just hench and they're just bulging with veins and all that. Like, I don't think Lee Haney genuinely influenced the sport on that level. I just think he took the accepted standards and made it as good as they could be, because during the mid-90s, they went to the super giant phase of bodybuilding. So I think he was, I can't say he influenced the sport really.
Basically, were you booking it, did you say?
It's one of them. I know you said like it's hard to consider professional weightlifting, or would you call it professional weightlifting? Is that what you called it? A sport. But I suppose there's a lot of other, you know, sort of games, sports, events, moments, or physical organizations that could probably be put into those categories. So I just can't consider it in a top 10 greatest sporting moments with what we have at our disposal to pick from.
I'll admit it's a personal favorite of mine, and there was a percentage of that was trying to bait you. So well done for not rising to the bait.
What are you saving this red card for, man?
Yeah, I know, man.
We've hit I know exactly what you're like, Flint. There's something in there that's just going to be horrible. And that needs to use the red for.
You're going to love this next one. Before we get there, it can't be in the top 10. As funny as it is and as great it is why to bis it up, it can't be in the top 10.
I'm happy enough.
Not to take away from the man's achievement. I'd still put him in the maybe. Not strong maybe. I'm putting him in that nether realm of maybes.
Yeah, definitely. Bissett just asked a question there. What would you call it? Bodybuilding or whatever. There is a massive difference between bodybuilding and powerlifting. Those are two different things, where powerlifting is like feats of strength, which is like way more in the sporting area, whereas bodybuilding is more like an aesthetic exercise. Even though it takes a lot of physical effort and a lot of discipline and a lot of, you know, long-term planning, etc. If I was going to put something like this in the top 10, it would definitely be on the powerlifting side of things. So, yeah, fair play, Bissett.
Right, we'll move on to the next one then. We're going to take a quick trip to the world of esports now. So back in June 2010, Hello Games, who you may know as the team behind the popular game No Man's Sky, released a side-scrolling video game incorporating racing and platforming. The game that I'm talking about is called Joe Danger. In this game, the player controls a motorbike stuntman, Joe Danger, and guides him through 10 levels to defeat his nemesis and rack up as many points as possible. Each of the 10 levels has a leaderboard, which would show you how your scores compared to the other 108,000 players around the world. The competition was ruthless, with players battling it out for that top spot. Amongst the battling, a young, unknown player was grinding away and developing a technique that would take the game to new heights. That player's name is Liam Flynn.
For fuck's sake. He's actually gunning for himself to be on the top 10 greatest sporting moments.
I've got a funny feeling he's going to hit at least three of these criteria.
Oh, he's definitely going to hit the criteria.
Liam had discovered an exploit using the turbo boost function. The boost is usually used to help you speed through the level or get more air off ramps. Liam had figured out that by performing backflips and timing the turbo boost as Joe's exhaust pipe was pointing towards the ground, you could essentially remain in the air indefinitely. And during these backflips, you could perform tricks to rack up your points. The trick here was to maintain a combo until the end of the level. This took patience and dedication, but eventually it paid off. And Liam started pulling off scores in the hundreds of millions, absolutely destroying all of the competition. Previous scores were like, at best, 50 million. Liam became world champ in about 5 of the 10 levels, and he reigned supreme for a good few months until one day he received a message on his PlayStation 3. The message read, "Hey buddy, check your Joe Danger scores." Liam went on to check his scores, and all of them had been beaten. He responded by saying, "I'm coming for you." But by that point, the fire had gone and Liam decided to get a life.
I feel like I know this guy. It's very, very strange. The dedication, the intuitiveness, the inventiveness, the adventurousness. I do actually feel like I've been at school with this guy almost. It's crazy. Which of the criteria doesn't it meet? I felt shockwaves through my living room floor when he broke the record. What do you think, Basit?
You should be on that Netflix. I think they did a Netflix series. Can't remember what it was called. And it was about people breaking records in games. And it was a guy that he broke like a Mario record in like 1984 or something. And he was haunted by the fact he couldn't get back to his previous best. And like he'd never ever been like close to his previous score and was constantly getting beat. But I know he's been put in there as a joke, obviously. But the fact that when you're reeling them off, the fact you've been a world record holder in anything, I think is impressive. Do you know what I mean? Especially something that might be considered like really competitive. I'm not sure how many users or how many players this game had.
Loads.
I had to look into it. It's so hard. This is my least well-researched point because there's just so little information about this game anymore. But on the leaderboards, there's 108,000 entries. Maybe there was more players because if you get 0 points in a level, you don't go on the leaderboard. But there was at least 108,000 people playing.
Where are you now in terms of the overall?
Good question. So I've spoken to two friends. I'll shout them out. I've spoken to Eamon and Hobo, who both have PS3s, and I've asked them to buy the game to find out where I am. And then they received an error. Hobo received an error while trying to buy the game. So maybe the servers are down or the PS3 doesn't even sell the game online. I emailed Hello Games to ask if they could have a look, but they didn't get back to me. So as actual evidence of it happening, it's just my word and the people who saw me do it, which is some of our friends back at home.
This casts a long shadow of aspersion over your entry here. How are the listeners supposed to ascertain the information that they need?
They all heard at the time. It was big news.
Yeah, it was actually. Good Morning Britain. Was Good Morning Britain even a thing then? I don't know. But yeah, I mean, fair play. I think I joined Bissett in giving you a massive pat on the back for achieving, especially for gaming, for us three. Obviously, we spend most of our free time avoiding our misses and spending time on the Xbox or the PS4. So yeah, absolutely sick. Of course, you're on the bonfire in terms of the top 10, but well done, nonetheless.
We're with the presence of greatness here, aren't we? We really are, aren't it? Do you know what I mean? What can you say? What can you say about Liam Flynn, world record holder, man?
Messi.
Shit's all over, card.
you get Messi, Muhammad Ali, Liam Flynn. All in the same breath.
I think that's in the wrong order, to be honest. The wrong order, definitely.
I was really expecting a harsh red.
I mean, the only reason we can't include that, well, there's two. Obviously, the widespread, if we're talking popularity, and we've generally been including that as an important part of our criteria. Yeah, 108,000 on the leaderboard. Could we possibly say it's nearer to 200,000 of overall users? I'd say that's a fair metric.
Could be.
Definitely very niche, way more niche than the long jump or anything like that. So, and also, are we considering esports? Me personally, I would consider esports. I actually would. But the small user base, and I'm not sure what the level of your competition was before you got that message from a guy who actually decided to go after your records. So you might have set the standard. But yeah, I'm not sure how significant that standard was.
I might be the dude who did the 4-minute mile first, basically. Yeah,
it does sound that way, man.
And it creates just a shame. I was going to say, it creates an interesting story in itself. Do you know what I mean? The fact that somebody was gunning after your record and then like had the audacity to send you a message and said, "Mate, just go and check your records, man. You want to go and have a little look at your records?"
Love that dude. I'd love to meet him. I'd love to meet him and shake his hand.
Watch someone insult the YouTube channel who just documents world record breaks. And like, gamers are just like that, aren't they? It's like, "Mate, check this out." Like, they love it. They absolutely love it. So yeah, sick moment. Maybe we should do top esports moments one day, man. It'd definitely get in there for me.
I think esports will be, it's definitely an emerging market for sure. And it's getting huge now. The sort of money that esports tournaments are generating and the prize money that they're giving to the competitors. So it's definitely ticking a lot of sort of criteria that would be considered a sport. So I think maybe in 10, 15 years, we are talking a lot more seriously about esports being in sort of like these sort of conversations. So we'll have to sort of like keep an eye on that as that sort of emerges. But shall I go through my number 14? So I think this is going to be a potential contender for getting in there. This is Michael Phelps winning 8 gold medals at the Beijing Olympics. I think it has to go down as one of, if not the most impressive moments at any Olympic Games, and sort of an absolute domination of the sport. And he set 7 new world records at the same Olympic Games while winning those 8 golds. So once again, not as sexy as an event as the 100 or 200 meters, but always impressive to see such domination in sport where the margins for victory and defeat are so slim. Obviously, with the Olympics coming around every 4 years, you've got that sort of one moment to do it in. And for him to be consistently so dominant is, I think it has to be marveled at, really. So what do you guys think?
You know, I actually think that the swimming is one of the hallmark events of the Olympics. I think it's the definition of sexy. I mean, they've basically got the cocks out. So in terms of Phelps's dominance, I think you got to go back to, was it Mark Spitz? Great surname, by the way, in 1984, who set the previous standard. I think he had like 6 or 7.
7 medals, yeah.
7. Thank you, Flynn. The only reason I'll discount this is the same basis that we discounted Usain Bolt, is that he was basically the Don. And it might have been a sick moment at the games, but I think it was expected up to a point. I think the only shock there was the number of medals that he got. So I think he was basically a big fish in a small pond. I'm sorry.
I was planning to red card this.
What?
I know.
I love it.
You'll see on my next point why. But because you were so gracious about the wrestling and the esports, I'm not going to.
He wasn't gracious. He just held his tongue, man.
How can you red card a guy that won 8 gold medals in a single Olympics?
We've got to hear him. We've got to hear him.
All right. Red carded. Done. And I'll explain why on my next go.
Holy shit. Red carded Phelps. Phelps. To be fair, I better red card something. I haven't used a single one yet. So, oh my days. All right, that's going on the list. I hope you clip this bit now, Bissett, because this needs to go on Instagram. He's fucking fuming.
Go on then, get on with it. Why are you red guarding it?
Well, it's going to wait for my turn, isn't it? Jim's next, and then we'll talk about why I've red carded it on my next go.
Okay, my 15th pick. So at the 1976 Olympics in Montreal, Nadia Comăneci, aged 14, became the first woman to receive a perfect 10 at the Olympic Games, scoring 7 perfect 10s in total en route to 3 gold medals in the all-around, the uneven bars, and the balance beam events. What the actual fuck, man? Like, I don't understand how this doesn't make the list. Talk to me. Talk to me, people.
What's the criteria of this perfect 10? Was it an upset?
She was the first ever woman, quote-unquote woman, to do it. But she was a 14, man. She was 14 years old. She was the first one to do it. She got 7 in the same games, 3 gold medals. If we're looking at it on a contextual basis, you'd only want to see the amount of golds this kid's won. I honestly think, like, this needs to go in there.
Influence the future of the sport?
Again, we're talking degrees, aren't we? I don't know if she made up, like, a sick new routine, but I watched one of her routines the other day, and it was fucking incredible. Like, incredible. Like, I haven't seen... We watched in last year with Simone Biles and all that. We were all watching it, men of culture that we are. She was doing mad little subtle techniques that I've never seen before. And that was like 50 years ago. So I don't know. Obviously, my gymnastic knowledge base is rather slim. But I would say that counts for something, man. She was killing it.
I'd say the age of 14, it's not as impressive in this sport, because I think being 14 and having a slight frame, and before you sort of, I don't know, let's say fully matured, maybe that leads itself into being better at the sport than you would be, say, when you're 26. Actually, I think it's probably more impressive as you get older to win achievements in these events.
Maybe, man, but mentally, I think. Well, maybe you're like young enough that you don't like you don't know enough to know what you don't know, kind of whatever that fucking
what you don't know
is. What you don't know, it's like the arrogance of youth, and it maybe that played into it. But I also think to perform like that under massive pressure, man, like I think 99.9% of kids would have absolutely folded under those circumstances. And she flourished. She went out, she did better than anyone had ever done in the history of Olympic gymnastics. I think she deserves a shout, man. I actually think she deserves a place in the top 10.
Her achievements are mad as well. Two goals in Montreal, three goals in Montreal Olympics, two in Moscow, on obviously on different disciplines. Nowadays, you get gymnasts that are experts in one discipline. For her to win gold in, what is it, three different disciplines, you said? So all around, uneven bars and the balance beam. Yeah, I mean, popularity outside of the sport is probably the only one in terms of the criteria that it may not be hammering home. But getting perfect 10 at the games as well. And probably around that time as well, you know, it's probably going to be a really popular sport. And sort of, you know, I think I want to say that maybe the Olympics was really sort of high profile back then, especially in these sort of, I think I watched quite a few documentaries around this time, 70s and 80s, where, you know, sort of like Olympics and the gymnastics like were kind of like really high profile as well. So I'm happy for this to go in, man. I'm happy this to go in, even if it's sort of to be reviewed later when we go through the strong maybes. But I'm happy this to go in, man.
I agree. Yeah, I'm happy for this to go in, definitely.
Fucking hell. I didn't think I was going to talk Israel, man. I didn't think I had enough contextual knowledge to convince you, but I'm throwing this in now before you can't change your minds, man. Poor Flynn issues another red.
Right, I'll go into my next pick. And this carries on from Bissett's last point about Phelps. I want to talk about the man who got the 8th gold for Phelps. If it wasn't for this event that happened, Phelps would be joint first most golds at an Olympics. But no one talks about this, man. I want to talk about a man called Jason Leeser. The way he closed the 4x100 meter freestyle relay with the greatest relay leg of all time, Beijing 2008 Olympics. This was the only event in which Phelps wasn't favoured to win. At the time, there was no chance. France were clear favourites. They were led by Alain Bernard, who held the world record in the 100-metre freestyle. Even before the race, Alain said, "Of course, we're going to crush the Americans. That's why we're here." And they did, mostly. Phelps led off for Team USA, and he set a new US record on that leg with 47.51 seconds. Australia were just behind, followed by France. Over the next two legs, Team France had overtaken the Americans, and it gets to this, the final leg, the last two men. You've got world champ Alain Bernard of France, yeah? And you've got Jason Leeser, old veteran. Up until this point, never won an individual medal, but he was a veteran of the relay. 32 years old. Some people say maybe past the prime of a championship swimmer. Anyway, Alain Bernard starts his leg. Jason Leeser dives in and begins his leg at a 3/4 body length deficit. So he's well behind the world champion, but he's well behind the greatest freestyle swimmer alive. And so Leeser decides to use the drafting technique to try and keep up with Alain. And for anyone who doesn't know, that's where you swim close to the lane of your opponent and you try to ride the wave that they create as they swim. Now, it's a risky maneuver. If you're too close or you're too far, it's going to have the opposite effect. You're going to get splashback and it's going to slow you down more than anything. The thing is, when Leeser dived in, he emerged close to Alain's hip, putting him at the perfect spot to draft. But that wasn't enough. By the time they got to the 50-meter point, Alain was still clearly ahead by quite a large margin. They both hit the wall. They flip. Alain's still well ahead. But in the final 25 meters, Alain seemed to start tightening up a little bit. And Leeser started catching up quick. He started going for it. It went down to like the final millisecond. Leeser hits the wall and he set the greatest split in the history of the sport at 46.06 seconds. Now, remember, this was the only one of Phelps's races where he wasn't favoured to win gold. Without Jason Leeser's comeback, Phelps would likely have had 7 golds that year and that would have tied him in Mark Spitz. And you know what? We might not have even talked about him today if it wasn't this guy elevated Phelps from joint first to the undisputed top spot. And that's, and you know, for anyone in doubt, watch the video. You see Phelps's reaction to when Lizak pulls it back. He's like, fuck, he's done it. He can't believe it. It's worth it just for Phelps's reaction. I still feel bad about red carding him.
I tell you what, Flynn, if there was an award for stories told on this podcast, you'd have a top 10 to yourself. But that was my favorite so far. That was my favorite. It's very well told.
I should put a shout out. A lot of the info from this is basically a condensed version of an article I read on yourswimlog.com. So I can't take all the credit there for that story, but I tried to condense it and make it my own. But
yeah, well, fuck those guys, right? You're my mate from school. So no, but honestly, very well told. Of course, we'd be talking about Michael Phelps regardless. Of course we would. And I think, as you say, your final point there speaks with relief. It's like, Jesus Christ, my boy's just saved me here. I think I've seen this on one of those like spine chilling fucking sports moments, top 50. Yep. I think I've seen this quite a few times, man. I'm not sure where to rate it. My I'm out of my depth in terms of my swimming knowledge. Yeah, I just don't I just don't know where to put it in the bigger picture. So Bissett, I'm gonna hand it over to you. I saw you making quite a few faces there. That's usually a good sign.
Yeah, I mean, I was gonna say the only reason he wasn't favorite is there's four guys in the relay, I'd assume, is there, Flynn?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All right. So the only reason he wasn't favorite is because he's got two guys that perhaps probably are not up to his level in terms of his ability. All right. Maybe there was one in there that had the best lap of his life. But what a minute moment to compare to somebody that's consistently won 8 gold medals or 7 prior to that.
Just to go back to that point, Phelps isn't a strong freestyle swimmer. The Frenchman is the world champ. I don't think Phelps even really competes in the 100 meter freestyle in the individual races. So that
over a butterfly, I need to be fair. Old Phelps loves the butterfly.
I was talking about Phelps as in like his overall achievement. I think to win 8 golds at one Olympics was the moment, and it. So that was what I was specifically talking about. Obviously, there was one small individual moment where this guy has contributed to him getting that 8th medal. But you can't take away from what Phelps did, what he did individually, innit? So
no one would know his name if it weren't for Lizak, trust me.
Yeah, he'd be
and that one laugh that he did.
Yeah, based on that, it's an interesting perspective to attack this from. Like to have, you know, Phelps, he actually derailed one of the top boys of Olympic history. Again, because it's a four-man thing. I actually side with Bissett here. It's the first thing that occurred to me. Why wasn't Phelps the favourite? It's because he's got to depend on three other dickheads.
No, that's not it, though.
No, you don't think so?
It's not his style, freestyle.
Oh, no, it wasn't that. It's like, yeah. Once you clarified that, I did think so. But I also thought that he wouldn't enter this event on his ones, would he? So it wouldn't even be a thing that's up in the air. So, yeah, it's kind of like when sprinters, they've got like a guy who's sick at the 100 metres, but they have him and the anchor role in the relay race or something like that. It's hard to discount Phelps on that level, but probably just red card Phelps anytime you see him, really.
Was it worth red carding Phelps? Definitely.
Absolutely. Favourite part of the pod so far. You next, Bissett, go on.
I don't know. I've got like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 left, so I might drop one or two of them out of it just in the event of they're probably not going to get in there anyway. So I'm going to go for Leicester City winning the Premier League title. And once again, it's a footy one. And we all probably knew this one was coming, innit? In 2015, 2016, after overcoming what is the biggest pre-event odds that any sport has ever seen, some bookmakers were given odds as big as 5,000 to 1. This after they stayed up after a remarkable turnaround the previous year, winning 7 of their last 9 under manager Nigel Pearson, who was then sacked in the summer ahead of the appointment of Claudio Ranieri and one of the best signings of all time in N'Golo Kanté, who went on to win back-to-back Premier League titles. So this one, in terms of meeting the criteria, I think it's definitely going to be considered in all of them. And just the sheer kind of shock that the footballing world had as it was emerging, do you know what I mean? As the season went on, I think it was about halfway through the season where they finally went to top. And then everyone was just, I remember just everyone saying like, oh, no, they'll lose a few games and they'll drop off. Everyone was just like, no, they'll drop off. But they just kept on winning, man. They had some amazing results as well during the middle of the season, that period, I think beating Man City 3-1 away. And they just kept on winning with this team of, you know, sort of Wes Morgan and Robert Huth in central defence, Danny Simpson, Mark Albrighton. These, and then obviously they had Jamie Vardy, who'd come up from, you know, being the first £1 million non-league player when they signed him from Fleetwood. They had some players they'd signed from France, Riyad Mahrez, who was an unknown player they signed from Le Havre. And just the team, they were never, ever in a million years anticipated to get anywhere near winning the title. And they should have really been relegation candidates, and they probably were prior to the start of the season. So for them to go and win a Premier League title when only six teams before them had done it, I think it was just a huge achievement.
Yeah, red card for me, mate. I'm joking. To me, the only reason I've even got a hint of hesitancy is because I've become so conscious of the cultural bias, because it's football. It meets everything else plus 10. I think it's one of the sickest things I've ever seen in sports overall. I think it deserves to go in, genuine.
I'd say 100% goes in, and I'll counter the geographical bias that you mentioned by saying the English Premier League is pretty much the most popular league in the world in heaps of countries. So I don't think we should worry about that one too much. Probably never going to happen again. I don't think it really happened before in modern football history. So yeah, it was incredible. Let's go.
I can't think of another time where you'd have relegation candidates winning the Premier League. That was talking about post 91 when the brand change came in. I think it's been every team that's won it, bar Leicester, has had cause to win it. You know, even when Blackburn was a bit of a shock, but as Bissett alluded to earlier, they had a massive cash injection, and you can always half fancy a team to do well with money if they've got enough of it. I don't think Leicester, I know they had new owners before that, but they weren't really on that mega money level. I think they made the absolute most of what they had.
And Ranieri as well, from a coaching perspective, they brought in a manager who was suffering that ignominy of when he was Greece manager, they lost to the Faroe Islands, which was just like a disgrace. Do you know what I mean? And all the history sort of Greece had prior to that. And to lose to a team that were like, I don't know, one of the maybe 10 worst in the world or something like that, and hadn't won a game in, you know, some of these international teams have never won a game in their history. And, you know, he comes in, maybe considered a little bit of a joke. Do you know what I mean? I don't think anyone really took him seriously. And for him to come in with this sort of like happy-go-lucky style that he's got, Ranieri, and he's sort of the cheery guy, and sort of like pressure, there's no pressure kind of that he comes in. Do you know what I mean? Pressure's like at home with my wife and my kids. And, you know, and just sort of, it was a real fairy tale in the sport. And obviously, you know, we've proposed a lot of football ones. But I think this one, out of all of them, I think needs to be considered.
What's even more unusual about that is that Ranieri just been sacked from Watford. Like, he hasn't done anything since. I know he's had a long-standing managerial career, but there's nothing to suggest that this is well within his pedigree. I mean, I know he went to second with Chelsea back in the day and kind of built up the foundations of Mourinho's squad, but that was like fucking 12 years before, you know. I don't know about it. It seems like fucking lightning in a bottle, that kind of situation. Yeah, definitely in there. I've already put it in the fucking list. So sweet.
So that'd make 9. So we've only got one spot open. And obviously, this sort of, we're going to go through and review them quick time at the end. I'm going to throw another one of mine in just because I've got 5. You've got 2. Flynn's got 1 left. This is going to be Phil the Power Taylor. So this is the most successful darts player in history. And his records are unbelievable, man. He won 214 professional tournaments, including a record 85 majors and a record 16 world championships. And the next closest player to match his record of 16 is Raymond van Barneveld on 5. So, and it doesn't look like anyone will ever break his record. I don't think they will, to be honest. I think it's remarkable domination within his sport. Obviously, the glaring sort of the glaring reasons that he might not get in are going to be, yeah, perhaps does darts get considered a sport? I think it is generally accepted to be a sport and not a game. So in terms of his domination, has to be up there. So I'll leave that one up to you.
The only reason I would exclude that is because of we're talking along the lines of a whole career again, aren't we? Tiger Woods, you know, Phelps, etc. The whole, okay, maybe Phelps is not a fair example for that anomalous red card, which I rate Flynn for dropping. But it's hard to determine the moment, to determine the actual time. Obviously, he needs to be considered. I definitely consider darts a sport because I think basically all the ingredients are there. But yeah, the one moment, the one, the hair-raising couple of minutes is all that I'm lacking. But his achievements are beyond criticism for me.
Yeah, I mean, you could find one if you dug through. There'll be like a 9 darter that he did, which is kind of, that is the hair-raising moment when it comes to darts, is somebody hitting a 9 darter, perhaps in a leg where he needs to win the leg or else he's out or something like that. There will be a moment there, but probably wouldn't be enough, innit?
You know what's mad about that? I actually watched all of Phil Taylor's 9 darters the other day, randomly. Like, I don't know what, it was a Sky Sports video. And they were all fucking sick, man.
Them hair tingling moments in 2 a.m.
That it were, yeah. I'm leaning away from this one just out of like more preference than anything. I fucking love darts, even though I'm shit at it. I do actually love the sport. So I don't know why I'm leaning away from it, but I definitely am.
The only reason I'm leaning away from it is because we've got 9 in that top 10 already. That's the only reason that's making me lean away from it. Amazing achievement, and I love to hear about someone dominating a sport like that, but we're getting down to the nitty-gritty. The next one it's got to be a banger, and is this big enough? I don't know. I'm gonna say
I've got 2 choices left, and one of them definitely beats this one 100%. So that's maybe that's like a bit of bias on my part, but I've got something in my back pocket that I think will beat this. So that's
I've got such a good wrestling one coming up.
Oh, I can't wait. Basically, would you like to go again based on the fact that you've got more or?
Yeah. All right. So I'll throw this one in. So this is another career one. So I think it's going to be.
I'm all right with the career ones.
I'm not against them, but I think there are other entries in this list that should be included based on career if we're going to include them. I think we have really with Ronaldo and Messi, but...
Yeah, very good point. All right, so yeah, this is going to be the greatness of Wayne Gretzky. So he's the leading goal scorer, assist producer, and point scorer in NHL history. He has more assists than any other player scored total points. He's the only NHL player to total over 200 points in one season, a feat he accomplished 4 times. And in addition, Gretzky tallied over 100 points in 16 professional seasons, 14 of them consecutive. At the time of his retirement in 1999, he held 61 NHL record, 40 regular season records, 15 playoff records, and 6 all-star records. So this guy, like, when you talk about domination in sport, like, he's up there, like, with the sort of people that are just never going to be matched almost, you know what I mean? So pretty remarkable career.
Yeah, I think you've alluded to it yourself, like fucking king of the hill, basically. But we're looking, maybe we're not looking for that We've walked this line, really, haven't we, between moments and careers? And I think maybe this is something we should think about before next year in terms of solidifying the criteria or maybe just evolving it. I'm looking for that moment, that time where he fucking smacked it. I know for a fact he's had a few last moment winners where, you know, maybe they were the favourites, maybe weren't, but he was absolutely the Don on the hockey rink. So I'm leaning away for the same reasons. And I think my next entry, I'm going to lean away from that. I feel like I'm talking myself out of it already. But yeah, looking for that moment, respect the career. Obviously, you should be in there on that basis. Yeah, but it doesn't have that one signified moment for me.
I think it's definitely a candidate for the top 10 because I'm considering careers and moments to be more than just one little bit of time. I'm all right with that, but we didn't really hash it out so much before, but it doesn't matter. The only thing is we got one spot left, so for us to induct anyone, I mean, we can still move things around afterwards, I take it, or we could put maybe the top 10 plus then all the strong maybes to the listeners for them
I think we should do the top 10 we settled on, and then do, I think we should have 2 each of strong maybes,
Okay.
And then put that out there if that's agreeable to both of you.
Yeah, right. I mean, if we've got 10 strong maybes, we'll just put 20 down and then they can just pick their top 10 in it. Yeah, cool. That's right. Fair.
With that said, then yeah, Wayne Gretzky in strong maybe for me.
So do you want to visit? You've got two left now.
So I've got two. You've got two. Finn's got one.
Okay. So my penultimate pick, I'm going to go for Hakuo Show on May 2016, the real Genghis Khan. He surpassed Kiao's record of 879 top division wins in a sumo wrestling, an earth-shaking achievement from a gaijin, no less. He retired in 2021 with the 45 championship wins, then the most in history. He had the most undefeated championship wins with 16, the most consecutive championship wins with 7, and tied for the most championship playoffs with our mucker, Takahana. Our top boy, Takahana. You know him, mate. So, that is my nomination. Hakuo Show, the real Genghis Khan. What'd you say?
I want a bucket, but let's hit the criteria. Did he upset anyone? Was this an upset, this feat?
I don't want to get all racial stereotypy, but as a gaijin, you're not really supposed to be walking into a sumo ring, into a sumo school, no less, and be like, darning it off.
Is that someone who's not from Japan, a gaijin?
Yeah, they're like outsiders, isn't it? It's like, okay. Guaylo.
Or is he Mongolian?
Yeah, he's Mongolian, yeah.
Right. So, okay.
That's pretty impressive. So that's underdog status, I'd say.
Yeah.
Because, definitely. You know, it's sport. You'd have to say dominantly played in Japan. I don't assume there's many other Asian countries that.
Now, I tell you what, the people that come in there, you see a few Hawaiians in there, a few Polynesians, but not really. I think it's mostly like dominated like the Japs.
There's a big sumo school in Hull, I think, something like that.
Bare fish and chips for the lads, man. I'm just making weight, £400, man. But yeah, to go through the official championships up until since 1909. So he's got the most by 13 ahead of Tihao. In the most undefeated championships, he's like got double the next guy, who's, I can't even pronounce these guys' names, Futabayama and Taiho again. They've got 8 each. He's got 16. And he's tied for consecutive championships, as I mentioned. And our boy, Takahana too. He's tied there as well. This does actually hit most of the criteria, I'd say. Earth-shaking. Do you know what I mean? Definitely earth-shaking.
It hits all of them except interest outside of the sport, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. Who the fuck knows? The first time I heard about sumo wrestling was in that Freakonomics documentary about how they throw matches for each other to keep each other in the circuit. It's really interesting if anyone gives a fuck. But yeah. There's no interest in sumo wrestling outside of Japan.
And these are superstars over there as well, aren't they? So absolutely massive geezers, obviously. And also like massive personalities. And I think they just have the world at their feet, and they can just get any woman they want, essentially. Do you know what I mean? They're like rock stars over there. So in terms of its like, you know, its importance within the culture of Japan, it's absolutely huge for him to come over and as a gaijin, and beat all these other the Japanese competitors and all the other guys. You know, I think he's impressive, and then hold that world championship where like you can imagine all the people in the arena are just baiting him to lose. Just something like, just saying,
this guy
cannot win. Do you know what I mean? He's disrespecting our culture. Do you know what I mean? You know, I think that should definitely go in the top 50, man. Definitely in the top 50. I'd put it in a maybe. Maybe we can put that to people. And
My only regret about introducing that is how I butchered all the names. So, yeah, I would definitely have that in my strong maybe. And if I knew more about the sport, I'd be able to articulate a better argument. But, yeah, I understand if it doesn't make the top 10. But I think you got to shout out lads like that who come in and basically take over. So,
yeah, man. No, I'm more than happy for that to be strong maybe, because it is an amazing achievement. And he faced adversity and he smashed it. And what other sports list is he popping up in? So fuck it, he can go in our one. Let's get him in there, in the strong maybes.
Sound. Do your last one then, Flynn. I've got a red card waiting for you, mate.
All right. So this story starts with a plane crash.
That happened. Fuck it out, Flynn.
Is this the miracle on the Andes?
It's not the miracle on the Andes. This one happened in Africa. So it started with a plane crash that happened on the 27th of April, 1993. The destination of this flight was Dakar in Senegal, where Zambia were due to play a World Cup qualifier against Senegal themselves. Due to engine failure and pilot fatigue, the plane crashed into the Atlantic Ocean just 500 meters off the coast of Gabon. All 30 passengers were killed. Amongst the dead were the chairman of the Football Association of Zambia, some journalists, coach and staff, and 18 members of the national Zambian team squad. 11 of those 18 had been members of the 1992 African Cup of Nations squad, including Efod Tshabalala. He was their most capped player with 115 appearances and goal. So the match gets postponed until August. It was supposed to be in April. It gets put off a few months until August. And Zambia were given the task of rebuilding around three players who had survived because they were playing in European leagues. So I imagine they were some of the stronger players. Their names were Kalusha Bwalya, his brother Johnson Bwalya, and Charlie Musonda. They hired Scotland's Ian Porterfield as the new head coach. Fast forward to August, there was still a World Cup to qualify for. So Zambia and Senegal, they draw 0-0 in the first leg, only for Zambia to come back and smash them 4-0 1 month later. All they needed next was to draw against Morocco and they'd make it to the World Cup, I think in the USA. I think this World Cup was supposed to be in. Unfortunately, Morocco won 1-0 and they topped the group by 1 point, dashing Zambia's hopes of qualifying. However, something I've not mentioned, in the months leading up to that match, Zambia had already qualified for the 94 Africa Cup of Nations. And I'll just run through how they did in that. Bear in mind, this is a squad assembled in a few months, yeah, where most of the top players from that country have been killed. This is how they did in the African Cup of Nations in 94. In the group stages, they draw 0-0 to Sierra Leone, but they beat Ivory Coast 1-0, so they get through. In the quarterfinals, they beat Senegal 1-0. In the semifinals, they beat Mali 4-0, and it's just Nigeria left. They get to the finals against Nigeria. 3 minutes in, Zambian defender Elijah Litana, he headers in a corner. 2 minutes later, Nigeria equalise. Then, the 47th minute, final goal of the game and the final goal ornament come, unfortunately, from Nigeria. Zambia had three close calls in the remainder of the game, but they never came back, but they still returned the home as national heroes.
Giroux, Flynn, the pick. Old switcheroo. Fucking hell. Again, your storytelling talents are fucking wasted, kid. What are you doing on this podcast, man?
This is like his own podcast, isn't it?
I'm telling you. But, you know, this is like a real Moneyball story, isn't it? The fact that they didn't win anything, it completely discounts it for me. Sorry, man. I'm really sorry.
Well, 20 years later, I think 2012, it's a whole different team, but one of the Bwalya brothers, he became a player manager of the team for decades after. And they made it to the finals of the 2012 African Cup of Nations against Didier Drogba's Ivory Coast. And what they did before the match, they went to the coast where the plane had crashed, you know, into the ocean. And they sat there and they just sort of talked about it, had a moment's silence, and they went and they beat them and they finally won the AFCON 20 years later.
Oi, that should have been your moment right there. That should have been your moment, not the other one. Switch it now if you want.
I'm so devastated we used the word moment, because we could have avoided Flynn's 30-minute anecdotes if we just would have said if we just would have said achievement instead of moment. We just would have avoided all these. Nah, I'm joking, man. I've loved them. I think that once again, it's an amazing story. It's like it reminds me of the Munich Air disaster. It reminds me of We Are Marshall, the university football team, and them losing all their coaches and all their players. And what a horrible moment for a country to have to see that, like all their sort of like the people they look up to, and then the, you know, the people that are sort of in the public eye and mean so much to people, to just go in that one split moment, and then them have to rebuild their whole sort of dynasty from the ground up. And like, as you said, it's impressive that they even sort of managed to get to the Cup of Nations and then also get to the final and play probably one of the tournament favourites, although they didn't win there. Like, it's a fantastic story. In terms of great moment, I still think it should be considered like up there. Not maybe not in the top 10, but certainly you're talking about great moments in sport that does resonate and it pulls on the heartstrings of a lot of people. So in terms of a great moment, I still consider it up there, but perhaps just not in the top 10.
Definite Busby Babes vibes coming off that story, man, for sure. Fantastic, Flynn. Jesus Christ. You're making me like semi-emotional here. Maybe it's the 300. Nobody down since we've been recording.
Again?
But yeah.
Again, I got to quote my sources here. It was a website called Sandals for Goalposts where they had the most detailed...
That's fucking jokes.
They had the most detailed story for this.
Sandals for goalposts. Why? Because it's African football stories, not jumpers for goalposts. That is
fucking hilarious.
That is jokes. Oh, dear.
I didn't need any other articles on the website, just this one, but he had a really detailed write-up. But I'll tell you how I come up with this story. I was hanging out with one of my friends here called Mwaka. She's from Manchester, but she was born in Zambia. And I was like, oh, I need some more moments. I was telling her about the podcast. I need some more moments. And she's like, oh, yeah, we had this moment where all our players died in a plane crash. It was hilarious. Like, as a dark joke. Like, so I was like, let me look this up. And it actually turned out to be quite an emotional story, actually.
To be fair, in the history of the continent of Africa, this might be a lighthearted story. Do you know what I mean? I think they've been through some shit over there, you know. And so, this one was pretty chill for all of us.
And to be fair, Flynn, you're like in the prime sort of cultural melting pot to be able to sort of get access to these stories, and it people from all sort of corners of the globe, where people like us, where we're solely focused on the sort of the popular sports. And we think that has to go in because it's a football one. That has to go in because it's an NFL one. That can't go in because it's in weightlifting. You're sort of meeting people that are like really culturally diverse from all corners of the globe that are like, nah, this guy and this moment was so significant in the place that I'm from. And I think, that needs to be sort of considered. And it should have a lot of weight because sport, at the end of the day, it affects everybody, doesn't it? And it affects everybody differently. But it's things like this, like, they stay with people forever. And it's so in that way that's what sport's all about. So
we definitely need to address this in future lists that we make, because it's opened up like what's important. Why do you consider something important? Why is this a sick moment? The variables are mind boggling, to be honest. They really are. That wouldn't get into my top 10, but now I'm thinking, like, anything could make the top 10, really, depending on your perspective.
It's exacerbated the need for criteria, hasn't it? Like, it's something that I was saying at first, we don't need a criteria. We'll just banter our way through it. But actually, you need, like, a 20-point criteria to really narrow it down. But anyway, should I do my... I've got two left, so that was Flynn's last one. Jim, you've got one left. Shall I reel off my two, and then we'll last one, yeah? Because you said your last one was a good contender. And this is going to pull on the heartstrings of Jim 100%. And I think he's going to find it tough to not consider this for a top 10. So this is going to be, I don't know whether to choose a certain round from the fight or choose the trilogy between these two fighters, but it's going to be Arturo Gatti and Irish Mickey Ward. Both the first and third fights, like, they were included in HBO's 10 best fights of the decade. And the famous ninth round, which was in the first fight, I believe, Jim, has been coined by some as being the round of the century and possibly the best round of boxing they have ever seen. And all that drama that was with those three fights, and then surrounding this sort of suspicious nature of Gatti's death, and the true respect that these two fighters showed each other, both inside and outside the ring, I think it cements the sort of their bouts in boxing and sporting history, and sort of this sort of legacy and the impact that he left on the boxing sort of industry as a whole. And to see the people that were close to both of them, to both Gatti and Mickey Ward, and the emotion. If you ever watched the documentary, I imagine Jim definitely has, but I don't know if you have, Flynn, but or anyone else listening, go and watch this documentary, man. It's an absolute beautiful documentary, and it really sort of it really shows like how much these two like went to war with each other, but they had an actual genuine deep-seated love for each other as well. So I just think like it's worth a mention anyway in for a top 50.
Well, you know me too well, Bissett. That absolutely pulls on my heartstrings. And the Legendary Knights documentary that you're talking about is, it is for me, yeah, it just, I could watch that any day of the week. Yeah, it contextualizes everything you're talking about. And anyone who doesn't have the patience for like an hour long documentary that goes into depth about this really niche boxing trilogy that happened, you should just watch a highlight video of the first fight. That ninth round is fucking ridiculous, man. It's absolutely ridiculous. It doesn't meet our criteria, but for me, this is up there as one of my top two or three favorite sporting moments of all time. Absolutely. Unashamedly, it's up there, man. I fucking love this fight. I love the trilogy. I love the circumstances surrounding it. I love the fact that Mickey Ward came on. He coached Arturo Gatti in his last fight when he got knocked out by Carlos Baldemir, who went on to fight Floyd Mayweather, actually, in his first outing at 147 pounds. Mickey Ward, the perennial down and outer, who's pulling himself out of the mire with body shots from like 95 to fucking 2000. Oh, I fucking love it, man. I love it. I just don't think it meets our criteria, man. But very, very good suggestion, man. Tino is going to be fucking punching me in the head next time he sees me for disqualifying.
Where will you put it then, Jim Strong, maybe, or top 10 or booking?
There's no way I'm booking this. I couldn't live with myself. I can't include it in the top 10 though.
I think he's arguing. I mean, this is before I wrote this up before we actually made the criteria. I think he's arguing that it doesn't match the criteria. So,
yeah,
shock factor in terms of an upset. I don't think it can be really considered, can it?
I think these two are a very similar level. I think Arturo Gatti, former, if memory serves, at least a former world champion. He may have been a former two-weight world champion. Mickey Ward had won fringe titles, but I think he beat a guy called Sanchez in the seventh round for the WBU, beat Shane Neary from Liverpool in a similar type of setting for like a WBU, WBF type of fringe title. These weren't at the pinnacle of the sport by any means, and I don't think you could consider a result either way an upset. The way it went down was fucking shocking. The fact that you would televise a contest of that brutality was shocking. It's a case for boxing being abolished, that fight. Honest to God. It's fucking, please, I'll compel anyone listening to this to go and watch that fight. First four rounds, it's a bit like, oh, this is just a normal fight. And after that, it gets fucking serious, man.
I'm happy to just agree with you on this one, Jim.
I can't exclude it, but a nice one. Is it for bringing
one of those an honorable mention? And I'm hopefully people that haven't heard about this, these fights, this trilogy, and that ninth round, go and watch it, and also try and watch that documentary, because it, in terms of like sporting moments, I'd say it's just a great sporting moment to watch and a great story in the world of sports. Right, I'll do my last one, then over to Jim. All right, so my last one is going to be a basketball one. And obviously the only basketball one we spoke about so far has been Michael Jordan's three-peat. But this is going to be Kobe Bryant's 81-point game, which sounds like unbelievable, even when, you know, you perhaps aren't privy to the context of basketball and obviously being a very high-scoring game. But 81 points for an individual in the game, in a single competitive match, is unbelievable. And to be that much better than the other pros on the court, where, you know, you have to be the best in your town, the best in your high school, the best in your college to even have a sniff of playing in the NBA. And he pulled out an individual points total against the Raptors, like actually outscoring their entire team in the third quarter. It's almost unexplainable. Obviously, rest in peace. Birmingham City have just scored as well, 1-0 up. Terrible. Nah, I should be continuing my
stay it. Oh, listen, keep that in. That is fucking that's quiet. That
continuing my ode to Bryant, but that's 90 quid. I've got to get to Tino if it stays that way. But now seriously, more importantly, Kobe Bryant, man, like a legend of the sport. Like horrific circumstances, and obviously, I think it cements his legacy really in terms of how good he was. But to score 81 points in a game is outrageous. Like I don't watch that much NBA, but I'll follow it quite a lot. And it'll be like, oh, Steph Curry has a brilliant fourth quarter, scores 32 points. And it's like, And then you hear about him scoring 81 points in a game. It's just like, it's so far ahead, seemingly, of what basketballers can do and what they're capable of. Like, I just think it's unbelievable. I honestly, I think it's a really huge moment in the game of basketball and on sport as a whole.
And he wasn't the youngest player when he did that either. You know, that's got to be taken into account. What was it? I've got it up here. 2005-2006 season. I think he's the second all-time highest scorer in a single game behind Wilt Chamberlain, who did it for the Philadelphia Warriors. I think that predates the NBA even. So that kind of shows you the level that Bryant was playing at. I think it could be considered, I'm not too hot on it because it's lack of maybe championship context. The one-off game, it's like a striker scoring 10 goals or something like that. But if the occasion is not there...
Yeah, it's an 82-game season, isn't it? So it could be... You don't know the exact circumstances of the game. You don't know whether the Raptors were leaving out half their squad because they were resting players. You don't know if like they were already out. Say, I don't know, their record was like 27-53 and they had no chance of winning. So, yeah. I think that does need to be considered as well. But I nearly went 2-0 up there.
This has got to get out of here, man. This has got to leave.
But I don't agree. I don't think it should get in the top 10 either.
Yeah, but RIP to the man. But anyway, regardless.
Would you put it in a strong maybe, though, Bissett? Would you...
For a top 10? Nah. I think it should get in the top 50. But definitely somewhere in the top 50. 1-1. Starts with the football commentary, but yeah, 1-1 now. I think it would definitely get in a top 50, but I think let's not put in a strong maybe. I think it's just super. As you say, Jim, it's lacking championship context. If this happened in the playoffs or in a championship game, then yeah, I think it'd almost like it'd be a shoo-in. It'd 100% be in the top 10. But the fact that it happened in a regular game season, we could find out the full context. I didn't do the same amount of research as Flynn does, albeit. But I think that's what's keeping it out. It's the big game moment that's keeping it out of it.
Okay, so we'll put that on the maybe pile, but it seems unlikely that it's going to be revised into there. So I'll give us my last pick and my 17th and final pick. And it is Steve Redgrave winning his fifth gold medal as part of the Caucasus Four at Sydney Olympics in 2000. The only man in the history of the games to win 5 consecutive gold medals and did so at the age of 38. One for the dads, really. I think that speaks for itself. Pretty similar to what I was saying about Nadia Comăneci earlier. It's or Comăneci. I'm still not fucking Comăneci. I'm still not sure. Romanian dialect is not my strong point. But yeah, I think it's very much along the same lines there. Pretty much along the same lines as Michael Phelps earlier. I think it deserves to go in there, but again, it's unsexy as well. Anything called the Coxless Four needs to be rebranded at the very least. So over to you two.
Sorry, I didn't catch the sport.
It's just rowing, isn't it?
Like the rowing. Yeah. Oh, fucking red card it.
I'm getting disappointed here. I didn't use a single red card this whole time. A single red card. Why didn't I, man? Maybe for the follow-up ep. That's it. That's the episode now, isn't it? If he's red card,
that's the one.
I think no matter what it was, it could have been any of those top 10 moments and Flynn would have red carded on his last one just because he wants to use his red cards, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can I save my red cards until next year? Because mine are in the bank. I didn't use a single one, man.
Carry your red cards over. Oh, maybe. Yeah. Maybe we refine the next list.
It might have to be next year. Maybe just the next little milestone we have. I don't know, the next 75th episode, we do something. Or, I don't know, every 10 episodes, we could do a special.
Nah, like allow this. That.
I mean, not quite as big as this one has been, like a much smaller version. We pick a few things each, like greatest sportsmen, women, or something like that.
Well, as it stands, we have a top 9 and a fucking hefty maybe pile. So, in the interest of expediency, and because I know Bissy wants to get away, and this has been a very long episode, we can talk on WhatsApp about maybe what we want to make up the top 10 for, present the top 20 from the maybe pile or top 10 or something like that. We can figure out the recipe, but from there, what would you say about leaving it there for tonight? We can get on with the hard figures throughout the week.
I think we should decide on that last one right now. I think we should get it out. I think Usain Bolt. I'm going to put a heavy case for Usain Bolt being in there straight off.
Who else is in there? Just quickly, Jim.
Okay, so we've got Usain Bolt, 100 meters, 2008. We've got the Fosbury Flop. We've got Mike Tyson versus Buster Douglas. We've got Maradona in the 1986 World Cup. We've got United winning the treble in 99. We've got the Invincibles of 3-0-4. We've got Ronda Rousey being elevated to champion status in the UFC. We've got Hoffa in the cycling. That's your suggestion, Flynn. We've got England cricket, the last down to the last over of the last wicket of the last... I don't know the terminology for cricket, but it's in there. We've got Tiger Woods, his 97 Masters win at the age of 21. We've got Greece winning the Euros in 2004, heavy, heavy underdogs. We've got the Cubs World Series win. We've got Schumacher's sixth world title win. We've got Frankel just being a darn horse. We've got Jack Johnson becoming the first black heavyweight world champion of all time. We've got the 4-minute mile. We've got the, what's it called? The Miracle on Ice. Now, is it the 1976 games? We've got Man City in the final game of the season. We've got the 1998 Hell in a Cell, King of the Ring. We've got Mike Powell's long jump. We've got Aboriginal Cafe, Verstappen. We've got Hakuho Show, and that's it, yeah. The only one I think is strong is, I've got a strong bias towards it. I think everything, it's a decent maybe pile, man. So
it's a great maybe pile.
I've got no problem with putting it up for the vote, really.
All right, so what we're going to do is we are going to decide amongst ourselves on the WhatsApp group what's going to be the top 20 that we agree on. We're going to put it out there for the listeners. They're going to choose their top 10 out of the 20 that we pick, a combination of the 9 that we already have and another 11 out of this maybe pile. And then you guys are going to choose as to what would you be your top 10.
Wicked.
Brilliant. Brilliant idea.
And Flynn is going to sign up to about 13 accounts and probably put Hell in a Cell in first.
I would not put it past Flynn at all, just for the jokes, man. Is it opposite of a company man now, isn't it, Flynn? It's absolute
snake.
Going back to Birmingham's changed me into just a gutter. Living in the gutter, man.
Gutter rat.
Gutter rat.
Right, so are we calling it a day? Yeah, is that the end of the episode?
That's it,
Let's do it.
Right, I'm going to go and sweat over this last 20 minutes, Blues versus Sheffield United.
All right, cheers.
Nice one, boys.
Cheers for listening. See you later. Cheers.